Our culture is in a crisis, and the solution to that crisis is the gospel message. St. John's Seminary, the seminary of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, offers an online MA in pastoral ministry degree for anyone interested in receiving formation for ministry. This program helps students improve their knowledge of the Catholic intellectual tradition and develop practical skills for ministry. A studio with professional video, audio, and lighting equipment allows our students to have an enjoyable technological experience, a necessity for any online learning environment.
Anyone who is working in and around the Roman Catholic Church in North America needs an education like this. There's no way you could get this kind of education anywhere than at a seminary.
Our online Master of Arts in Pastoral Ministry offers you the chance to continue your education in ministry and designed to provide you with the knowledge, spiritual formation, and practical skills that you need to serve the family of God in our parishes, schools, and other ministries.
By grounding yourself in the intellectual tradition of the Catholic Church, you will be able to go out into this culture and leaven it with the good news. Welcome to the podcast. My guest today is Dr. Kevin Ahern, who is a professor of religious studies at Manhattan College in New York, where he directs the Dorothy Day Center for the Study and Promotion of Social Catholicism. Dr. Ahern is also the chair of the Dorothy Day Guild, the association working for the canonization of Servant of God Dorothy Day. He is the author of Structures of Grace, Catholic Organizations Serving the Global Common Good, and editor of several books. Kevin has served in leadership of several national and international organizations, including the International Movement of Catholic Studies and the ICMICA Pax Romana. First of all, Kevin, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to have this conversation.
On this podcast, we've done multiple episodes on the Catholic worker movement. I did an episode on Dorothy Day. I don't generally do on location episodes, but I went to one, the Catholic worker here in Los Angeles about a year ago, and other episodes, and also have done one episode on the canonization process of saints, and then got set up with you by our mutual friend and repeated guest on the show, Dr. Andy Starin. And what I wanted to talk today is about bringing those things together, those themes together, and talk about the canonization process of Dorothy Day, because you are a part of that cause. So that's the general conversation topic for the day. Why don't we start with the sort of the history of the canonization process for Dorothy Day? How did it start and what stage is it at now?
Great. Yeah. Thanks for asking this question. Over the past year or two, thinking and working on issues related to Dorothy has occupied quite a bit of my professional and free time. So even my 2 year old or almost 2 year old can recognize Dorothy, which is really kind of funny. Right after Dorothy's death, or even shortly before her death, and we can probably get into that, people kept talking about Dorothy as a living saint. So there was conversation about Dorothy's sainthood even before her death, which isn't necessarily the best thing to do. Right. But a few years after her death, the Claretian Fathers in Chicago, they started a process to call for her sainthood. And that was a short-lived effort, but a very noble effort. But it was, you know, in the church, it's really up to the local bishop to take up the cause of one's religious congregation to take up the cause for sainthood. So Cardinal John O'Connor began the process for Dorothy's cause, which basically another way to say case, right? So the word cause, right? He opened the case for her canonization in the year 2000. And with the Vatican's permission, she was able to be called Servant of God at that stage. That initiated a series of conversations among people who knew her, living witnesses, which we were privileged at that time to have a lot of people who still knew Dorothy still alive. Of course, many people had passed already, but there was still a good number of people alive. And there are a few still today who knew Dorothy as adults and knew her personally. And so there was a process of initiating the conversations of interviews and testimonies. In 2005, these people who were close to Dorothy, with the approval of the Archdiocese, established what's known as the Dorothy Day Guild, or the Guild for the Canonization of Dorothy Day. And this initiative, or this association, this group, was charged to really take up the effort of getting the case ready to be sent to Rome. And what's really interesting about Dorothy is that she was a journalist and a writer. So she wrote a lot. And a lot of people kept things that she wrote, and she kept a lot of things that she wrote herself, including diaries and letters and all the things that she wrote in magazines and newspapers and books. All of that had to be found, compiled, transcribed, and put through a series of theological censors to make sure that everything was okay. So that took several years of work, very hard work. We employed over 100 volunteers who, for example, would take scans of her diaries and transcribe them. It was this yeoman's work of doing this. And eventually, we had 50,000 pages of paper in several boxes, think 3/4 of a ton, if I'm not mistaken, that in 2021 were blessed symbolically and sealed by Cardinal Dolan with red wax in a ceremony in St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York, and sent off to Rome to begin the Roman phase. So the Dorothy Day Guild is still continuing its effort to try to share Dorothy's life story, to try to collect any reports of miracles or graces and favors. But we're also supporting this effort that's happening in Rome as we speak, where these 50,000 pages that we sent off to them are being sorted through and looked at, and a summary is being developed for that. So we hope soon, once they get through all that work, that there will be nothing found blocking the case, and that if that's the case, and God willing, and with the approval of the Holy See and the Holy Father, that we will be able to that the next stage in the Roman phase will go, and she could be declared venerable. It would be beautiful and wonderful if that could happen in the holy year of next year, in the Jubilee year. But we'll let God and grace and the Vatican take its course on that. But so we're in between the local phase and the Roman phase, essentially. She's still servant of God, but we're hoping that venerable, that next level, if you see things as levels, will come soon.
And assuming she does become declared venerable, what then would the next sort of step in the bureaucratic process be?
Right. So we're continuing to collect any reports of graces and favors and potential miracles. And your podcast with Monsignor Sarno was great in sort of detailing that. I loved especially how he described on that you know, the role with saints, right, is the two I's he used, right, of intercession and imitation. And we know that you know, the miracles are granted not by the person that we're praying with, but by God through the intercession of that person. And so we're hoping that, and we could speak a little bit about that, that we will get some more reports of miracles, or some of the reports that we already have received might bear fruit. And then maybe then she could be declared blessed. Then, of course, a second miracle later on, God willing, and confirmed by the Roman authorities, would be able to be declared saint and be canonized. So I hope, I pray that this will happen in my lifetime or my children's lifetime. You know, it would be a wonderful, glorious thing if it could happen, even when some of her grandchildren are still alive. But you know, at least something blessed would be beautiful. But we'll celebrate her, even if we're still in this, even if it's a slower road than some people might want.
And what is your role in this process?
So I chair the board of this Dorothy Day Guild. I also run a center at Manhattan College in New York, which is a college sponsored by the De La Salle Christian Brothers. And we have an exhibit on Dorothy's life with several items related to from that her family has donated. We're also working with her family and the New York Catholic Worker and how to preserve items in her bedroom to try to make sure that the historical record are preserved. Marquette University has her papers, and they do an excellent job of archiving elements of her sort of documentary life. But we're hoping to be able to shepherd educational resources in the New York area for this woman, because even if she is not declared a saint, or even if that takes a long time, she still offers a really interesting model for young people to engage and raise questions about the gospel and evangelization and the Eucharist and the meaning of holiness and the works of mercy and peace building and lots of things. So we're hoping to find ways to do that educational outreach a bit more effectively. But the work with the Guild is primarily to collect any reports of graces and favors, to fundraise for the costs of the canon lawyers and the work of the dicastery in Rome, which is quite a lot of work on their part, and also and perhaps more importantly, in some sense for me as an educator, to raise awareness about the life of this woman and her reading of evangelization and the gospel.
One of the things that you had mentioned a moment ago is sort of going through her things, not just sort of her writings, but her material things. And you've, as I understand it, had a role in determining what to keep, what not to keep, and just in general, sort of for historical reasons, but then also for the cause itself, what might be relevant. How do you decide what to do with those things, what to keep, what to throw away, what's relevant for the cause? The historian in me, I don't think, would be able to handle a burden like that. I would, you know, keep every little thing, which I know is what you're not supposed to do. So what's your sort of process in thinking about that, or sort of criteria you have for making those decisions?
Right. No, I think you rightly point out how challenging these things are. And of course, anyone who's had a family member who's passed away, who's had to go through their objects of their lives, right? We know how difficult that is at a personal level, right? For Dorothy, and this is, you know, she's a more contemporary, if we could use that word, I think so, right? Contemporary. She died the year I was born, but maybe I want to ask you, Stuart. But, you know, she's someone in our lifetime, right? So it's she had a lot of things, right? But people knew as she was dying, or people after she died, they wanted to keep her things. And someone occupied the room, a friend of hers occupied the room at Mary House where she died after her for several years. And then when he passed, they sorted through and tried to figure out, okay, so which of these books, which of these things belong to Dorothy and which did not. Now, of course, Mary House, the Catholic worker community in New York, is living and acting the works of mercy. They're not equipped, they're not designed, they don't have the charism to be a museum, nor do they want people just showing up at their door. So don't just show up at the door and ask to see this. They're busy feeding people who are hungry, right? And clothing the naked, living those works of mercy. So me, as an academic, as a theologian, with some resources from my university, if I could come in and help and assist that. So one of the things I did is I had a student intern last year, and the nominally Catholic, who didn't have much experience with Catholicism and certainly with saints, helped me to sort through some of these things and make a new inventory of Dorothy's bedroom, and especially the books, because we wanted to make sure books were so important to Dorothy, and she had so many of them, that we wanted to make sure that they were in well order and trying to clean them, etc. But, you know, the student could not believe what we were being asked to do. There were drawers full of some of Dorothy's clothing. There were, you know, checkbooks. There are, you know, various things, but also other things, letters and other things that needed to go to Marquette, which will take care of the documentary heritage. But what do you do with these things? She's not, no way are we claiming they're anyway relics, because that's a stage later on in the process. And so we're not talking about that, the R word, if you will. But are there things that are historically important or that can connect us to her life? I'll give you one example, which I think is really telling to me. On Dorothy's dresser, They have, she had a box. Now, lots of us, I'm sure I have one, I'm sure lots of listeners would have this, where you put knickknacks or random buttons or things that you don't know where else to go, little things, maybe some medals, maybe some holy cards. In this box, Dorothy had a lot of medals of saints that people had given her that she had collected. There were also rocks that said, you know, this came from Egypt, or sand from a certain beach here. And she loved nature. She loved the beach. And there were a lot of second and third class, or there were a lot of third class relics, right? You know, little medals that had touched the cloak of a saint, or, you know, we all know what these, a lot of us know this type of collection. What that, and my student did a beautiful job of documenting these items. But what this said to me in a very profound way, which no book of Dorothy could ever communicate, is how embodied of a person she was in her relationship to her faith, right? Mm. The physical things, even a little rock from the Sinai Desert in Egypt, right? These physical things, right, were important to her. And so very much Dorothy's faith is very much of an incarnational faith, an incarnational spirituality lived in the world, in the flesh and bones and the rocks and the sand and the seashells and nature and the Eucharist. And so, and the poor person coming at your door, right? So she had this incarnation. And so this, so finding ways to preserve this is of historical importance. But of course, we don't want to spend an obscene amount of money doing any of this. So several of the items the family had donated to the college that we put together an exhibit at Manhattan College that is open to the public. If anyone wants to see in Riverdale, New York, we have items from her life in several display cases, including many people will know the iconic photo, and this is close to you in California, of her in her last arrest with the farm workers, where she's wearing a big broad rim straw hat and sitting on a stool. So that hat, the dress she wore, the purse she wore, the stool that she sat on, the shoes that she had, that's all in a display case, right? And we're using this as, and some rosaries of hers, some prayer books. We're trying to use this as a way to bring high school groups, college groups, others into Dorothy's life. So without disturbing the actual lived experience of the Catholic workers downtown.
One thing that doesn't necessarily make Dorothy's cause unique, but probably rare, is that she was a layperson. She wasn't a martyr. She was a mother. She was a grandmother. She lived in the world. How does this rarity, sort of a rare case, shape the way her sanctity is perceived throughout this process?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question, and that motivates me a lot as a parent. I struggle to find models of sanctity that are lifted up by the Universal Church of people who change diapers or who experienced a kid going through a tantrum, right? Part of the thing that inspires me personally about Dorothy is she understood some of those aspects of parenthood that that are not, you know, that. So for me personally, she's a helpful guide on my own spiritual journey. I remember reading one of her diary entries and was really moved by, and this is appropriate for today on a hot day, I was really moved by an account she describes of taking her daughter Tamar and a friend of her daughter's to Coney Island and getting ice cream and riding the amusements. And I just said to myself, there's something really, obviously, as a parent, we can experience some trauma with giving kids ice cream, but there's a lot of grace, right, in bringing kids ice cream. And what does that mean, right? I'm really, you know, I'm intrigued by that. So that, you know, that I think makes her cause for me, that's an element of her cause that often doesn't get enough attention as a mother, as a grandmother. Dorothy's granddaughter, Martha Hennessy, who will be speaking at the Eucharistic Congress in a few weeks, said that the first time she experienced God's love that she can remember as a child was having her grandmother hug her. And, you know, maybe a lot of us can empathize with or can think of times where we felt God's love and the embrace of a grandmother or a surrogate grandmother or mother or other parent in our life or father. So I think there's something important about uplifting that, those experiences, those stories. But of course, for Dorothy, life was a little bit more complicated, right? Before her formal conversion, right? She had her time, which she describes as a time of searching. She had experiences that might not reflect what lots of people might describe as contemporary elements of sanctity and holiness. And certainly her biggest regret was having an abortion, which she really lamented and struggled with for her life, that memory of that. But you know, that's for some people that's going to be used against her. And so that, you know, but I think the church is finding ways to work on that. But so Dorothy's life as a woman who understood, you know, love in a marital relationship, even if she wasn't in her common law marriage with the father of her daughter. You know, that's, I think, another model that we could go down as something as we could that needs exploring at some point.
Earlier, you mentioned miracles. Mm-hmm. Miracles are part of the cause of canonization for anyone. Have there been any miracles reported, and how are they being investigated?
That's a great question. So one of the things that I have that has surprised me in this process is how much real comfort and joy comes from hearing these stories that people report of graces and favors and potential miracles. So some of them are simple graces and favors, saying that, you know, Dorothy gave me comfort when I was sick. And, you know, those are all on our website, thedorothydayguild.org. People can report things like that. We welcome these stories because they show how she is part of the life of believers, the Universal Church. We would love to collect any things like that. Now, some people even say that they found a parking spot in New York City with her. Okay, maybe that's a bit of a stretch, but maybe not.
I don't know, man. Parking in New York, that is a miracle, I think.
It's, you know, I can't tell you how many times I found a spot right in front of the Catholic Worker. I think we've received a few that are more, you know, more serious accounts of miracles. And so we have in the Dorothy Day Guild a doctor and a retired nurse who are our kind of first line of vetting, who go through and listen to this. We've received several interesting potential cases that we're exploring. Some we had to rule out, sometimes they don't fit the criteria that the Holy See has laid out and its norms. You know, one example would be, which people don't maybe know about, is if you're praying with more than one intercession, like let's say I'm praying for something with a healing or something with Dorothy and with Blessed Pier Giorgio Frassati, for example, we wouldn't know if something came about which one was listened to. So in some sense, that's both, and I think Frassati would get take precedence if they did that, but I think both are kind of ruled out. Miracles, people get so caught up on miracles, and they get so caught up on physical relics of bodies, and they, you know, my students love this stuff, right? but the key thing is, how do we use those as doorways, as entryways, to say, okay, this is a really interesting person who lived their faith in a way that can inspire us to live our faith today. And that, I think, is exciting. But you know, I'm hopeful that we'll get some miracles coming. But we want more people to pray with Dorothy, because we want more people to know about her and to honor God in that way.
I'm sure you've been asked this a million times, but I feel obligated to ask it. Dorothy is famous for saying, "Don't call me a saint. I don't want to be dismissed that easily." First of all, did she actually say that? I'm constantly hearing people say, "Well, Augustine said X, Y, and Z," and I'm like, actually, no, he didn't say that. But second of all, if she did say that, what do you think she would make of this process?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's a great question and an important one. And as Robert Ellsberg has said several times, you know, lots of people can quote that, but can't quote anything else from Dorothy. Right. Yep. So it's a great pithy phrase. And if it resonates in that way, it must have some value. Now, likely she didn't say those words exactly, but the sentiment was she wanted to be taken seriously. Right. So Robert Ellsberg will talk about how has described this in his writings. But about this question that he often gets. But she didn't want to be dismissed. Well, we often do this thing with holy people where we can domesticate them, or we can put someone on a pedestal, and that can say, all right, well, Dorothy's going to live these beautiful lives, these works of mercy. So, but I'm not a saint, so I don't have to do it, right? So it sort of takes the responsibility off of oneself to put it onto someone else. They're the whole. My sister is, or my brother is, the holy one. I can do whatever I want, sort of thing. So there's that element. The other element too is, you know, in the 70s, but also today, and we see this a lot. When there have been real problems when we've lifted up living people as living saints, especially if we come to discover maybe they weren't as holy as maybe they perceive to be, and so there's a risk of that. Dorothy was very concerned even early on, and that this great quote, I think it's from the 40s, it might even be earlier in the 30s, that people are disgusted by the idea of holiness. Now, I think this is an interesting question because there are so many Pecksniffs in our midst. I had to look up what Pecksniff was. It was a Dickens character of someone who was kind of hypocritical, right?
Okay.
So, but, you know, I would want the saint of the time to say, I don't call me a saint because it's about Jesus. It's not about me. Right.
Right.
So I think Dorothy's humility is present in sort of those comments, but it's a bit more nuanced than that. Clearly, Dorothy said several times, we are all called to be saints. That was a very important part of her own spirituality, is that we are all called to be saints. This year, we celebrate the 60th anniversary of Vatican II's document Lumen Gentium, which talks about that too, right? But Dorothy said this in her own words in many places, that we are all called to be saints. She has a great phrase where she says, thank God for the feast days of the saints, and I'm paraphrasing this, because it reminds us that we are all called to be saints. We're all called to be this. So she wasn't against sainthood. Now, the question about the bureaucracy. Now, in your interview with Monsignor Sarno, you maybe got a sense, and listeners can get a sense of the long process which comes through the church's wisdom as to avoiding excess and really trying to make sure that the person we're lifting up is a model of heroic virtue and witness worthy of imitation and veneration. I think, you know, that process takes time. It certainly is more expensive than a lot of us would like, but you know, for something that's lasting 30, 40, 50, maybe longer years, and we're using a lot of volunteers, it's not as much. But if that process distracts us from living the works of mercy, then something's wrong. And I think that would be true for any sainthood, right? You know, the news about the advancement in the cause of Carlo Atticus, right? If attention to his cause distracts one from adoring the Eucharist, or from adoring Christ in the Eucharist, right? We're doing something wrong, right? So we have to not. Saints are not ends in of themselves. But my hope is the other aspect, and is as a parent of three small children, I really want someone like Dorothy in their CCD books, in their catechetical books.
Yeah.
I want her. And if this is a way to get more people to learn about Dorothy, then let's do it.
There is some opposition to this cause. Certainly, there's always been people who don't like her, even in her own day. But even some Catholic workers themselves are against it. Can you talk about this opposition and how would you respond to it?
Yeah, and one of the things that is unique about the movement that Dorothy started, the Catholic worker movement, is that it's not a monolith. There's an anarchist movement. There are lots of different opinions. It's a really the miracle in many ways that it doesn't qualify according to the Vatican standards, that is that this movement continues and continues to grow without a centralized core, without a statutes or bylaws, in many cases without any like formal government or formal legal or bank accounts, that this group continues to grow is impressive. There are people in the Catholic Worker who are very supportive of Dorothy's cause for sainthood. There are others who firmly believe she is a saint and don't really see the value in any formal Vatican process. There are others who are opposed to the bureaucratic structural process because of what some of the things we were just talking about, the finances, and that they're worried that she will be pinned as as, you know, sort of a two-dimensional figure that is only concerned with one issue, and she'll be robbed or stripped of her radical prophetic edge. But there are a lot of Catholic workers who are supportive of the work of the guild and supportive of this. And so it's a mixed conversation, but I think it's a very healthy conversation. And it's one that in my classes, my students love to engage and ask, you know, it's a great case study. Should we work for her sainthood? And you can get those other conversations on the mix. There are some other people who may be worried about Dorothy being too radical, perhaps, or in her polarized political context. Maybe she's seen in a polarized political way and might be worried about that. Others have a really hard time, and one can understand that, you know, that how her abortion early on maybe should be considered more. But those are things that are some of those are healthy conversations, but others are just you know, people being persnickety. Sure. So I think it's really neat to see the healthy conversations around this because it gets to the point about what is sainthood and what is the role of saints in our lives in many ways.
Saints are always patron saints of something. For example, Augustine is a patron saint of theologians. Is part of the cause of canonization to argue for what Dorothy should be a saint of? If so, what would you like to see her to be the patron saint of?
Ooh, that's a great question. That would be a really cool, fun game for us to play at our next board meeting. But I maybe we'll do that. But I have seen Dorothy the need for someone to be a patron saint around nonviolence. Mm. Pope Francis has drawn new attention and in Fratelli Tutti, but also in his World Day of Peace message on nonviolence. To the importance of Christian nonviolence, of gospel nonviolence. And I think Dorothy modeled that in ways that are exemplary, that need more attention. So that would be something, you know, so many of the other patron saint things that Dorothy are related to are maybe already taken. I think that maybe ice cream, maybe that'd be another thing. there's probably already a patron saint for gelato.
Probably an Italian.
Yeah.
A few questions about you, if I may. Sure. How has your own spirituality been shaped by Dorothy Day?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I, as I said, as a parent, it's been really helpful to me with three young children. You know, it raises for me the question about, you know, there's a certain interrogation here. I'm not a Catholic worker. I don't do nearly as much with the poor as I think I should. And that's something that sits on me and I continue to wrestle with that in my own personal life journey and spirituality. It on the cause for peace, you know, I think Dorothy really challenges me to get involved in the world. And recently I've been thinking and praying a lot on Dorothy's Eucharistic spirituality. And I think, you know, there's a beautiful image that this woman, Eileen Egan, another saintly figure who worked with Dorothy and also worked closely with Mother Teresa of Calcutta. In 1970, Eileen took Dorothy on a tour throughout Asia, and she brought her to Calcutta to meet Mother Teresa or to be with Mother Teresa. And there's a scene that Eileen describes of Mother Teresa and Dorothy kneeling before the Blessed Sacrament. And that Eileen reflects on how these two women are inspired by the Eucharist to go out and serve the poor. Dorothy describes that if we approach the Eucharist, but then don't act on it, and I'm paraphrasing here, it will be, quote, like a dead weight in our heart. Thinking a lot recently about the connection between working for peace and working for the works of mercy with people living in poverty and the connection to the Eucharist, that's been a real part of my own personal spirituality recently.
I just published a book in February on the fruits of the Eucharist, and there were six fruits or effects, and one of those six had to do with social justice. And I mentioned Dorothy Day and Peter Morin in that chapter. What have you learned about sainthood in general by going through this process?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think how we need more non-European saints. I kind of knew that. And we need more saints that can inspire young people. And so when I bring models of holiness into my classroom as a teacher, it's always interesting to me to see who and how gets the students going. And I've had many students really be inspired by the life of Dorothy, but also be inspired by people like Franz Jägerstätter and Oscar Romero and other contemporary figures who I think are modeling these types of things. So the question about what can get young people going, I think, is something that that I've been thinking a lot about with that process of saint and the role of saints in the world.
Why do you personally want to see Dorothy canonized?
I had said before, I would love to see my children's catechetical books have it, but I would also like to see the church, especially the church in the United States, take seriously, more seriously, and continue to take seriously the works of mercy and the Beatitudes.
You have recently opened a new center at Manhattan College on Dorothy Day, and I think you sort of mentioned it earlier as sort of being part of this. Well, actually, let me back up. How is the center different from the guild that I had mentioned earlier? I'm assuming there's some overlap, but the center itself, it was blessed by Cardinal Dolan back in February. Talk about the mission of the center. How is that mission different from the mission of the guild? And what are the ways that you're sort of living out that mission?
Great question. So the purpose of the center is to study and promote social Catholicism more broadly. It's named after Dorothy Day. So Dorothy Day would be an important part of it. We have the exhibit on Dorothy. We also house the offices of the Dorothy Day Guild. So the
Okay.
guild had its offices at the Archdiocesan Center in New York City. And a few months ago, I backed the family minivan up into this tall building in the middle of Midtown Manhattan and loaded up with the boxes of our archives to bring to the college. That was a fun experience. The minivan filled with some of these documents. And so, but we so we have it's a collaborative relationship there. So the center has a bit of a broader mission. We have other programming besides programming on Dorothy. But we've had an annual lecture related to her, doing more of the academic components as we could, and so trying to bridge those worlds together. Yeah. So we o had this our center blessed and opened a few months ago by the Cardinal. We've done collaboratively with the Guild. We've done teacher training workshops. We just had a few dozen teachers from Catholic high schools in the New York City area come to Manhattan about a month ago to learn about how to teach about Dorothy in their classrooms. And that's kind of a fun, exciting thing because a lot of these teachers didn't meet other may, meet have rare chance to meet people, especially from different dioceses and different high schools. And we were able to share some best practices and teach on that. We're doing some we do some other programming on peace building and work against on nuclear weapons and the struggle the church's work to combat nuclear weapons. So those are some of the programming that we're doing at the center, but often in conjunction with the guild. Since I'm in both spaces,
Yeah.
I it's hard to separate sometimes.
Sure, I would imagine. In June, you recently had at the USCCB meeting, you put together a breakfast with the first annual Dorothy Day Peacemaker Award. Tell us about that.
Yeah, great. Thanks for yeah. So this actually was a suggestion that came from Cardinal Dolan. We were discussing how maybe more parts of the U.S. Church could be involved in Dorothy's cause and not just a New York thing. I mean, she lived in many parts of the United States, but I think it's the she's an American, one of these American candidates, along with several other wonderful people that are being proposed for sainthood. So Dorothy, so we suggested could we, and it was the Cardinal who suggested, well, what about an award? So we proposed, and with the support of the U.S. Bishops Conference, we organized a breakfast right before the June meeting of the bishops. There are a lot of groups will go into the U.S. bishops meetings in June or November and have a cocktail reception. And we felt like maybe drinks are it's too much and maybe too expensive. And, they're not quite our style. So we were able to do a simple breakfast to give this Peacemaker Award. And we had over a dozen bishops come to listen to conversations on Dorothy's life and the importance of peace building. And we gave the award to Pax Christi USA, which recently celebrated its 50th anniversary. So we're working on thinking of how we can better promote Dorothy's legacy as peacemaking and the beatitude of Blessed are the Peacemakers. So that was a great experience and a way of showing that Dorothy's relevance is not just in New York.
What do you make of the canonization process itself? Certainly the Catholic Church is known for its dense bureaucracy. I would imagine that this is one of the more burdensome bureaucratic processes, though I could be wrong. Would you say that this process is what you would expect on that sort of administrative level, or is it more burdensome or less than you would expect?
One of the things, and you can maybe get this from your other podcast too, but one of the things that surprised me or is intriguing to me is how few people are in this dicastery in Rome. Working on these causes coming from all parts of the world. You have a few dozen people there and with consultors and others in the dicastery for the causes of saints. And so things work slowly and in the church, slow is not bad, right? So thank God we haven't, canonized some people too fast that might have come up with some problems or secrets or skeletons in the closet, right? It's good to go slow. But there are lots of causes from people from various parts of the world that might not get as much attention. Or in the United States, there's an effort for what they call the saintly six, these six African-American men and women who are holy models that are out there. And some people are frustrated because they feel like it's going too slow. I think slow is not always bad, but part of the challenge is that there is understaffing and under resources. Mm-hmm. And that might be surprising for some people to feel like that there's under resourced elements there. I do wonder if, one of the fruits that might come out of Pope Francis's effort of the synodality, I wonder how that might impact the canonization process. I wonder, for example, is there a way to decentralize some of this into regional structures without creating extra bureaucracies? I don't know. I think there's worth, surprisingly, I think it needs more resources, surprisingly. Mm-hmm. That's a weird thing to say. And especially when we know that finances are limited and that there's often the priority needs to be people on the margins at some level. But I think there's also this process can be streamlined a little bit better with more support. So, that's something I've been thinking a lot about.
You'd mentioned earlier that one of the things that you had realized about Dorothy Day is sort of her incarnational spirituality. Are there other things that you've learned about her that you didn't know or the public didn't know through going through this process?
Yeah, so a lot of people have an image of Dorothy as a sour, dour old woman. And, one, you can get to know her and realize that she had a joy. She had a magnetism that, I think no one starts a movement or a religious congregation or follows people like they did with Dorothy or like a St. Francis or an Ignatius or Catherine of Siena. If they don't have a magnetic personality, if they don't have some joy, right? So we have this image, and I think it's part because we have these photographs of her later in life as an older woman that we might miss her youthful enthusiasm and her joy, or what Pope Francis might say, the joy of the gospel, right? Pope Francis Evangelii Gaudium talks about, right, there are some Christians who are Lent without Easter. I think Dorothy was much more Easter than Lent. You know, I think that gets missed, especially as people talk about her denunciations of the evil and injustices in the world. But they maybe forget that she's also announcing the gospel and announcing the good news in her very life of witness, and with a sort of wry, maybe New York sense of humor that might not always translate across generations. And so her love as a parent, her love to her former romantic partner, who she broke up with when she became Catholic, but she was desperately hoping that he might return to her, and get married and agree to get married. And in many ways, if Foster had done that, maybe she wouldn't have started the Catholic Worker. But I think she was a living human being, not just a dour. But we do that with so many saints, right? So many images. I don't know about your churches, but so many images of saints are, they look kind of boring and kind of like they're not smiling. Who would follow someone if they were not happy, right? So I think that's something we have to, that's something that really surprises me and makes me feel good about her.
Final question. We are a people of hope, specifically hope in the resurrection. What gives you hope for Dorothy, not only her canonization, but as we were talking about earlier, for more attention to be paid to Catholic saints who are, as you say, non-European, lay people, mothers, fathers, husbands, wives, working people, the ordinary saints, if you will.
Yeah, so or Francis says the saints next door, right? But I would, and obviously we have these saints in our lives that are next door that we are confident in their sanctity. We're confident in their presence, and their love of God and their love with God. But there are some people like Dorothy who are worthy of lifting up as exemplars. I tell my students, I have had the poster of Michael Jordan in my kit in my bat in my room, right? How do we as a kid, how do we lift up these exemplars? I would just end with maybe this. I was teaching a class 2 years ago on Dorothy, and I had students go down to the Catholic Worker as an optional thing. One of the students, a tough New York Latina first generation college student, she comes into my classroom after going down to the Catholic Worker, and she is in tears and crying. And I was terrified that maybe something violent or something had happened to her on the way there or the way back. And she said to me, she grew up in a Catholic household. She went to Catholic churches, and she was sexually assaulted at a church, and she felt like she couldn't go back to a church ever again. But in going and to seeing the work of the Catholic Worker today, she saw God at work, and she said she didn't believe that there were Christians who took the gospel seriously. And this is a 23, 20-something-year-old young woman. And then she said something I'll never forget. She said, there was something inside of me that was broken, that was healed. And I almost can start crying if I think about it too much. What is inspiring and gives me hope is how there are all across the United States and in many other countries, there are young people who hear about Dorothy and they go and they go and they go and they live the works of mercy and the Beatitudes. And they encounter Christ in a way, even if they don't know or even if they can't name it as Christ in that particular moment in time, they encounter Christ in a way that they don't see perhaps in their normal everyday way. And something inside of people that are broken gets healed. And I think that's a beautiful sign of hope in our world.
Well, I think talking about an encounter with Christ is the perfect way to end this conversation. Dr. Hearn, thank you so much for this conversation. Thank you for your hard work on this. I'm sure I'm not in charge of a center, but I'm in charge of a program. I have to deal with bureaucracy all the time. I can't imagine the headaches you have to deal with. So thank you for your hard work on this. As someone who is deeply admires Dorothy and the Catholic Worker, and I've been a cheerleader on the sidelines for a while about this cause. So not only thank you for this conversation, but for all the hard work you and others at the Guild and others who are part of this process, the nameless volunteers who help with the transcribing, this all small steps to get her to hopefully that day where she'll be canonized. So thank you so much for this conversation, for all that hard work that
Thank
you
you.
do.
And I invite people to go into dorothydayguild.org to sign up for our newsletter if you're interested to learn more.
And I will definitely post that address in our show notes. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Bye. Thank you.
Our culture is in a crisis, and the solution to that crisis is the gospel message. St. John's Seminary, the seminary of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, offers an online MA in pastoral ministry degree for anyone interested in receiving formation for ministry. This program helps students improve their knowledge of the Catholic intellectual tradition and develop practical skills for ministry. A studio with professional video, audio, and lighting equipment allows our students to have an enjoyable technological experience, a necessity for any online learning environment.
Anyone who is working in and around the Roman Catholic Church in North America needs an education like this. There's no way you could get this kind of education anywhere than at a seminary.
Our online Master of Arts in Pastoral Ministry offers you the chance to continue your education in ministry and designed to provide you with the knowledge, spiritual formation, and practical skills that you need to serve the family of God in our parishes, schools, and other ministries.
By grounding yourself in the intellectual tradition of the Catholic Church, you will be able to go out into this culture and leaven it with the good news.